I invite you to open up to 2 Samuel this evening. It's good to see each and every one of you here. And I want to turn our attention this evening back to the life of David. I've been looking at this reign of David for some time, and there are so many things to notice there, so many applications, I think. And trying to figure out what all to deal with, what all to put into sermon form, as it were. Taking a close view of some situations and then kind of backing up and taking the overview. And I think, well, I have settled on it. My sermon is prepared. So what I've decided is to take that sort of broad view this evening. Just look at the whole thing. The ups and the downs. The times where David just seems to be doing everything right. Literally at one point it says everything he did, the people loved it. And then there's just times where you talk about utter failure. I mean, he just doesn't even seem to know which way's up there at times in his reign. And I just want to look at those distinctions because I think that by comparison, we can see how David ruled in such a way and not only see the good things that he did, but by using them in contrast to the faults, they shine even brighter and hold those up. And then also be warned that even a man who shone so bright could fall so hard at times, and what it means to try to avoid those occasions. There are some obvious applications to us here at Pepper Road right now. David, when he came in 2 Samuel chapter 1, really, Saul is dead and Jonathan is dead. And we have that song that he sings on their behalf. And so he goes from there to Hebron. But the kingdom, it's not like a switch. I mean, it's not just, okay, well, now on to the next king. And, you know, this is sad, but let's move forward. It doesn't happen like that. In fact, it's kind of a messy situation. It continues to be a messy situation for quite some time. And in fact, when we finally get to the point that the kingdom does come together, the very next chapter is when the situation with moving the ark occurs and Uzzah is put to death. And so there's a stumbling along the way. And it does not seem very long at all before we're to 2 Samuel chapter 11 there with the fall with Bathsheba. And then after that, well, you just have a series of failures of David, both as a parent and as king, as he sits by and watches his kingdom just sort of crumble away from him till in shame he leaves the capital city while his son usurps the throne, and not only usurps the throne, but makes a mockery of David's reign. He would have to rely on those who remained loyal to him to wrest back the kingdom from his son. And then he came in and he showed some vigor again. Rising up after they had taken the kingdom back from Absalom. And he recognized this could be even worse than Absalom. And so he puts that down. Then we go a little further. And it says that the Lord thought it good to incite David. And we find over in the Chronicles account that the devil came in and tempted David to make this census. And we see that. And so it's just an up and down. It's not so much that you come in here and you see a meteoric rise and then you come to a climax and you see a meteoric fall. It's just up and down all along the way. So I kind of want to put the good together and put the bad together. And try to get some pictures about those things. And I'm going to try to give some context as we go along. I know most of you will be familiar with the story as we go along, as we make references, but some of you may not. And so I'll try to put those things in context enough so that we'll understand as we go along. Because we're going to be looking at a lot of passages and we don't have time to read really most of 2 Samuel. So we won't have time for that, but we'll just make reference to these things as we go along. But I will say this, I'll tell you where we are, and we're going to stay pretty much in that book of 2 Samuel tonight. So looking at David on the rise, looking at David when he is doing so much that is good. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago as we were looking at waiting on the Lord that David so much relied on the direction of the Lord. And particularly we looked at 2 Samuel chapter 2 there, that after the death of Saul and Jonathan, and after he has reacted to that and with not only the justice toward the one who claimed credit for having killed Saul, but also with the elegy that comes there in the last part of the chapter. It's his. I mean, the kingdom's his, and this is what he's been waiting on. But it says there in chapter 2 and verse 1 of 2 Samuel, it came about that afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." Well, not only that, it says, so David said, "Where shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, and so forth. And so David doesn't just go on with assumptions, even though maybe even he's got some good basis for assumptions. He goes back to God. He goes back to God and he asks for advice, and he's constantly going to God. We find that to be characterized, especially throughout the beginning of his kingdom. And we see it again reiterated in chapter 5. In chapter 5 now, all right, so several things happen at the point in chapter 2. If you're not familiar, one of Saul's sons, Ishbosheth, rises up and he decides he's going to be king. And so the commander of Saul's army, Abner, decides he'll go with Ishbosheth, and they make their kingdom up on the what would be on the eastern side of the River Jordan in Mahanaim. And for 7.5 years, the kingdom is in turmoil. And so, at any rate, by chapter 5 of 2 Samuel, we've begun to repair that, and the people come back to David. And what we find there in verse 10, it says, David became greater and greater, for the Lord God of hosts was with him. You go on in verse 12, again it reiterates, and David realized that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. Oh, that Saul could have realized that. You know, Saul had early successes, but they went to his head in another way. He didn't think, look at what God's done for me. I must show loyalty to God. No, but that is what David thinks. David remembers how he got here, and he recognizes God's place in that. Then down in verse 19, we see that phrase again. Then David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines?" When is that ever going to be no? You know, when does God say, no, leave the Philistines alone? It always seems to be a good idea to go up against the Philistines, but he asks, "Should I go up against the Philistines?" And of course here, the Lord says, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." And so he receives. But he never assumes, he never presumes on God's word. And the confident actions of David as we see him, he doesn't seem to be the kind of second guessing, kind of unsure king that he will be, especially immediately following his sin with Bathsheba. He is in the right place, and he is ruling as king, even when he's only partially over the kingdom. They're only with the tribe of Judah for the first several years of his reign. I might point out that there are times where David is not receiving direct revelation, because you might look at that and go, well, that's all well and good to be able to say, well, you just do what God says, when God is directly saying, go to this city and handle it this way and do these things. But there are times where he wasn't receiving direct revelation, and yet there still seems to be a reliance on God, not only with David, but with his generals. And we find that in 2 Samuel chapter 10. In 2 Samuel chapter 10, this is immediately following an incident with the king of the Ammonites. And it's an unfortunate, it's confusion's not the right word, but just an incident between the nation of Israel and Ammon, because David had actually gone out in a sort of a diplomatic way to show some friendship. And the new king of Ammon had some very bad advisors, says, "David's trying to mock you." And so they insulted the emissaries that came from Israel and sent them back with their clothes and their beards cut off. And so they basically started a war. I mean, this is an act of war at that time. And so David sends out Joab, and he sends out Joab's brother. And so Joab and Abishai are there. And what happens is Ammon hires some people and they surround them. And what we find Joab saying in verse 12 here of this chapter is interesting to me. So he gathers his forces. Joab gathers his forces. He gathers Abishai's forces. He says, we're going to fight this way. You fight that way. If I need your help, you come over here. If you need my help, I'll come over there. And then in verse 12, he says, be strong and let us show ourselves courageous. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And then this, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. In other words, you make good choices and then you rely on the Lord. And I mean, it's God didn't give them direct revelation. Say, here's how I want you to lay the battle out. Now, they're acting on good information as far as that goes. But when the good information runs out and when you've got to make a judgment call, as it were, then you say, this is what we'll do. We'll make a good decision, and may the Lord do what is good in his sight. And I think that that's the attitude of David's kingdom as it's on the rise. When David is making good decisions, when he's making right decisions. But I'll tell you something else that characterizes David that is astonishing to me, and that is his patience. So going back all the way to before this, we look back to the time when David is a lad. What does that mean? Teenager, probably. Before David and Goliath. After Saul has already been told the kingdom is going to be torn away from him back in 1 Samuel chapter 15. For not utterly destroying the Amalekites. Samuel is despondent and God tells him, I've got something else for you to do. And of course, the next thing to do is anoint the next king. And the next king is going to be David. But you think about that from the time of 16, 17, I don't know how many years old, all the way until the age of 30. David not only has to wait his turn, I think that would have been fine. I mean, I think David's disposition would have been fine to merely wait his turn while he served in the army of the king. But he has to wait his turn while being hounded for all of his successes. For everything that he offers up as service to God, he is sort of punished by Saul as Saul chases him throughout the kingdom. And not only that, but on more than one occasion, his own people, the children of Israel, sell him out to Saul. In fact, he would go hide in a city and then he would inquire of the Lord and the Lord would say, you better get out because they are not going to protect you. And so he continues. Now, you just put that in your head. All right. So when we get to this point of the kingdom being in turmoil, remember, it's not just what we find starting in 2 Samuel. There's a whole history here with the children of Israel that David has gone through already. Then Saul dies. All right. Now all bets are off. And incidentally, the people know because in chapter 5, they come to him saying, we know. They come to him saying, we know that God has told you to be shepherd over the people. But that takes 7.5 years after Saul died. And during that time, it's not entirely peaceful. There's war. There's skirmishes going on between David and the people of Ishbosheth, the military of Ishbosheth. And Abner is gaining territory all the time. I can't imagine being in the position of David and being in the position of trying to move towards the goal that you know God has set before you. And trying to figure out why this isn't falling into place like it should. And you've got people like Joab, who it seems to me would probably give the advice, let's march out right now and burn every city to the ground that does not yield fealty right now. And then maybe you've got, and I don't know, maybe you've got people in Judah going, look, maybe we should just all get behind Ishbosheth at this point. I mean, look, they've got most of the nation on their side, don't they? But David knows what's right. And he just stays the course. He's not inactive. He's not doing nothing. He is fighting those skirmishes. He's doing the things that he ought to do. Let me just point to where we're at right now. People might be saying, I wish whatever's going to happen would just happen. But don't we all? But what if it doesn't? What if there is not a quick resolve, or at least a resolve as quick as, I certainly hope it doesn't go on 7.5 years, but honestly, it may not end soon. And you may go to the elders and say, let's get this cleared up. Don't you know they wish the same thing? It may not work out that quickly. And so we may just have to progress little by little and get back towards the resolution that we want. And let's have some patience with them. Let's look at this man who certainly went through a lot more than we have gone through in trying to get to a united place with the kingdom of Israel. Along those lines, David is so balanced. It is hard to pigeonhole David. It's hard to say he's this kind of man. In 2 Samuel chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, there's the occasion where the young man has come and he's taken credit for having put Saul to death. And there David says, "You thought to take the life of the Lord's anointed." And he tells his men, go slay him. And so they do. Chapter 4 and verses 11 and 12 is where the two men come down from Mahanaim, where they have slaughtered Ishbosheth in his bed. And he told them about the previous story. He said, I've had this happen before. A man came to me and thought that he could get credit for killing God's anointed. And you thought it would be all right to go into the bedroom of a righteous man and take his life. Incidentally, referring to Ishbosheth as a righteous man. And I David's magnanimity in all of this is astounding. But his magnanimity is not ignorant of justice. And so he says to those two men that they will suffer the death penalty. And so they are killed and displayed for their crimes. And yet on the other side, we have Abner, who has gone and taken up with the usurper, let us say. He has gone and sought to build up the kingdom of the one who has no right to the kingdom. And then they have a run-in, Ishbosheth and Abner, because Abner sort of exerts his power. And in response there, Ishbosheth, Abner takes the wife or the concubine of one of Saul's concubines. Ishbosheth takes that as an insult, and then he finds out that really all the power was in Abner's hands the whole time. And so Abner says, well, we're done here. I'm going to go give this whole thing over to David. And so that, I don't know that that makes Abner a very admirable person. And yet, when Abner comes to David with the prospect of putting the pieces back together, David holds a feast. He doesn't say, how dare you come to me to even have a conversation? No, he lays out the feast table. And they have this conversation, and Abner basically says, let me put this thing in your hands. Let me bring the children of Israel to you. He's already been talking to him. He already has got some support. And he says, let me bring them to you. And let us make a covenant. Let's make a truce here. And David says, good. And so Abner leaves. The next thing, Joab walks in, and there's Joab on the other side again. Joab walks in and says, I heard you let Abner get away. And it's like, no, I didn't let him get away. I sent him away in peace. Abner, and of course, Joab will have none of that because in a battle, Abner had killed Joab's brother, and so he conspires, and in a method that will become, I think, somewhat characteristic of Joab, he almost literally stabs Abner in the back. But here is David. David doesn't get into the personal grudges. He doesn't get into the personal, oh, I've been insulted. He wants peace, and he works towards that in so many different ways. Chapter 5 and verse 2. I said earlier that the people came to David and they show that they knew what God had said. Can you imagine this? Here it is. Let's just go back to verse 1. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, behold, we are your bone and flesh. previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in, and the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron when they anointed David king over Israel. Oh, I just have such a hard time figuring out what I would say to those people. Yes, I do seem to remember when I led the people out, and I remember when you did not support me in that. Yes, I do remember that the Lord said I would shepherd the people of Israel and rule over Israel. I remembered that for all 7.5 years that I've been waiting for this day. And I think maybe if I were in charge, it would look like something like the Reconstruction South, only this time it would be the North. Yeah, you can come back to this kingdom. There's going to be conditions. No, David, he wants to put that back together. Sometimes we'll say about someone, I tell you what, he's a straight shooter, and that guy right there, he doesn't take anything off of anybody, and he just puts people in their place. There's a place for that. David knows when the place for that is. On the other hand, I hear people say about somebody, you know, he just never gets upset about anything. Nothing seems to rile him up. He just stays laid back no matter what the situation. Well, David can be laid back, but I'll tell you what, he is neither one of those things all the time. And we don't want a guy that's either one of those things all the time. I'm offended if somebody can never get upset about anything. And I'm certainly offended also if someone can never tell it like it is and say what needs to be said. And David exemplifies that balance. And it's a balance that we want. And so if you're thinking with regards to our leadership and how they handle things, understand that they are constantly trying to strike that balance. And sometimes you'll probably think they sway one way or the other. And let me just say, if you think that, there's somebody at the other end thinking they're going towards whatever you prefer. And no doubt that would have been the case with David, too. But all in all, he stays focused on the good of the kingdom during those times of good. When David is on the rise, he keeps the kingdom in the forefront. I picture particularly this time with Abner, when Abner's been slain by Joab. And here, it's not just that David's upset. There is a little bit, David is not a politician per se, but he's a wise man. And what he sees is, it matters what the kingdom thinks about what I think about what just happened. And so David, in a very public way, beginning in verse 35, it says, all the people came to persuade David to eat bread, there in verse 35, while it was still day. But David vowed, saying, my God, do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down. Now all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. So all the people in all Israel stood that day that it had understood rather that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner, the son of Ner, to death. Then the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? I am weak today, though anointed king, and these men, the son of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. Here David goes out of his way, and we're going to contrast this later. He goes out of his way to show the people where he stands and where he stands with regards to what just has happened. And he wants them to know that he has no part in that. You say, well, I'm not sure exactly what the application is there. I think sometimes leaders have to go out of their way to make sure people know where they stand. And we wish they would kind of keep some things to themselves, and they just can't. They just can't. They have to make things clear so that everybody understands where we are. Well, I want to contrast this to the falling side, and there are many failures. On both ends, before the sin with Bathsheba and after the Bathsheba, there are two particular instances where I think we can see David sort of just relying on whatever seems best at the time. The first is the story of moving the ark there in 2 Samuel chapter 6. And there in verse 9 it says, this is kind of priceless, his reaction. After the ark, after they've made their attempts, the ark has been upset. Uzzah reaches out. Uzzah's been struck dead. David, it says, is angry with the Lord. And then in verse 9, it says, David was very afraid of the Lord that day. And he said, how can the ark of the Lord come to me? Now, this I find interesting. What are we supposed to do? Well, in the ark, there's some very specific instructions about what we can do here. And I think sometimes when people go about making decisions about what's the right, and they say, you know, you'll sort of have questions about whether it's church discipline or whether it's how we deal with any particular situation, some doctrinal situation or some situation with a member. What are we supposed to do? Like there's no rule book at all. And here's one thing that I do respect about a leadership here who is always ready to say, this is why we did it this way. And they don't ever kind of throw their hands up and say, what are we supposed to do? That's what David seems to be doing here. I did what I thought was best. But how does that match up to this? Over in chapter 24 in verse 2, again, we have the numbering of the people. And there, as I mentioned before, it says that the Lord thought it good. He wanted a reason to punish the people, it sounds like. And over in 2 Chronicles, again, it says that the devil is the one who entered in on this occasion. But can I just say a word about that? That when it says that the devil entered in, that does not take away free will. Anytime it says that the devil is involved, when there's a temptation and so forth, you know, with Cain, sin is crouching at the door. Who's the choice? Well, it's his choice. David, it's not like David just lost control here and the devil took over. But the devil put something before him. And it sounds to me like God knew he'd take it. And so David goes down this path. Again, not looking to God, not asking God what was best, but doing this. And even Joab reminds him in response to this in chapter 24, when he tells Joab to go and to number the kingdom, Joab turns around and he reminds him. Very humbly, he says, now may the Lord your God add to the people 100 times as many as they are, while the eyes of my Lord the king still see. But why does my Lord the king delight in this thing? And so he even gives him an out, an opportunity. And David, like those people who asked for a king in the first place, no, but I will have it. And he sends him out. And so sometimes we get into that mode and we just think from right here, from the gut. Where's that gut been trained? Well, not necessarily the Word of God. The gut's been trained by all the noise that's going around us. We've got to train our minds by the Word of God and evaluate what's best by the Word of God, not just the emotion. And that kind of goes to our next point. David is utterly driven by emotion when he is failing. Go through and read 2 Samuel 11. Look at that downward spiral. He sees the woman. What does he do? Well, I'll tell you what he doesn't do. He doesn't take time to meditate like we talked about this morning. He doesn't go to his own words about, you know, keeping oneself pure and holy and true. He just acts. Who is that? Well, that's Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah. Well, there's an opportunity to think. She's married. He doesn't think. Bring her to me. He lays with her. He sends her home. And then he finds out she's with child. He doesn't think, what's the best thing to do? What's the next step? I know I've messed up. How do I repair this? He only thinks in the terms of fear and panic, paranoia. And so he goes and calls Uriah. And he tries to set up that situation so that it looks like it's the child of Uriah. Uriah will not play along, so he sends him back to battle with his own death notice. And all along the way, it's almost as if David is acting in a fog of emotion. And I say a fog because when you get to chapter 12 and Nathan puts that story before David, he doesn't even see himself. And that's interesting because later when Joab will pull the same stunt in order to bring Absalom back, he'll send a lady to kind of tell a story. David sees right through it then. But here, he's so angry in chapter 12 and he says, we're going to take care of it. And Nathan says, you are the man. And it's like the fog lifts for the first time. The emotion has been set aside and he sees himself. He's humbled. And he breaks down there. Over in chapter 19, we see the emotion. But emotion without any good action. And we'll look at that in just a moment. But here in chapter 19, we find there it says Joab comes in. This is after Absalom has rebelled, after Absalom has been killed. Joab comes and delivers that news, and David is mourning and he's covering his face. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. And it is a heartbreaking picture. But Joab comes into the house of the king and he says, today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters and the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Contrast that with David sort of recognizing that the people needed to see him mourn. Here he takes no account of what the people need to see. He takes no account of what this is going to look like, as it were. And Joab, for all his faults, comes in and says, do you understand what this looks like? And so David, like many before him, like Aaron there after Nadab and Abihu, has to suck that in and say, I don't want these people to think that I do not appreciate what they have done for me. And so while there is grief and while there is sorrow, he has to step up and show that putting the kingdom back together was a good thing despite the cost of the life of his rebellious son. Well, along those lines, he is emotional, but he lacks resolve. Even though he gets upset at times, and even though he seems to certainly know what's going on, he doesn't always do anything. You have a situation with David's son Amnon and his daughter Tamar, and most of you are familiar, and I won't go into too many salacious details. You can read that there in 2 Samuel chapter 13. But after all that has played out, it says there in verse 21, when the King David heard of all these matters, he was very angry. That's it. It doesn't say, and then the next thing that he did, no, that's it. He just got upset. I tell you, that is a worthless leadership right there. That sees a problem and just sort of says, man, I really hate that. And Absalom's over there going, what do you mean? You're angry. But that's all. That's all that David rises to. Down in verse 31, after Absalom has struck down Amnon because David doesn't do anything about it, and the report comes to him. I don't know. It's just kind of a strange report. The report comes, hey, it's only one of your sons, not all of them. You know, that's kind of how it's delivered to him there in verse 30. The king arose, tore his clothes and lay on the ground, and all his servants were standing by with clothes torn. Verse 39. Absalom has fled, gone to Geshur there in verse 38. And the heart of King David longed to go out to Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon since he was dead. David just kind of sits around. He looks and he sees things. And he sees things that are bad and he sort of wrings his hands and he says, oh, I wish that I could do something. And let me just say, I shudder to hear parents say things like that when there's a problem in the home and someone comes and says, I want to talk to you about your children. I see some things that concern me. And a parent goes, I know, I'm concerned too. But what can you do? Well, I guess you could just sit around like David and do nothing. And just watch the whole thing fall apart. And then mourn. My son, my son. Oh, Absalom, oh, Absalom. I hope that's not the kind of leadership that we would want, but rather we want that resolve that David used to have where he saw something and he did something and he stood up against things like this. What's worse with David is that when he does take action, he takes half measures. Over in 2 Samuel chapter 14 there, as I said, Joab realized that David wanted Absalom back, but he wasn't going to do anything. So Joab decides to kind of take it in his own hands. And he goes and hires this woman from Tekoa. And he brings her in to tell the story. And she lays out this story of the one son who's gone. And she can't be reconciled and so forth. And before it's over, David says, who sent you? Did Joab put you up to this? And she sort of, Yes, he put me up to this. But then we come down to verse 24. And he brings back Absalom, tells Joab to go bring back Absalom to Jerusalem. Verse 23. However, the king said, let him turn to his own house and let him not see my face. So Absalom turned to his own house and did not see the king's face. Oh, yeah, that's good. That's going to help. Let's not repair the situation. Let's not address it. Let's not try to figure out how to resolve it. Let's figure out a way to make really everyone upset. Let's sweep it under the rug. That's what this is. But it doesn't actually ever get to any resolve. It's sickening to watch. Well, as you continue to look, it says there in verse 32, it happened when David was, back in verse chapter 14 in verse 33. So when Joab came to the king and told him that Absalom wanted to see him, he called for Absalom, and thus he came to the king and prostrated himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. Let me tell you what leads to that. Absalom is out there banished. He's not allowed to come before the king. He tells Joab, I want to go talk to the king. Tell Joab to come to me. Joab doesn't come. So Absalom, this is a jewel of a guy. So he says, hey, set his field on fire. So he does that. Then Absalom comes. Joab comes to Absalom. And that's what gains him an audience. And it still seems David just sort of sits back and says, all right. All right, I guess you can come back. Still, there's no true reconciliation. Nothing's happened here except let him slink in the back door. Now, I know that David wants this reconciliation, but he doesn't put any energy behind it. He doesn't put anything behind it that brings real, true reconciliation. I might just say this. Compare the reconciliation, the shadow of reconciliation between David and Absalom, and our reconciliation with God. God doesn't just let us slink in the back door. And it doesn't look like this. He has put himself out in order to make us reconciled to himself. Worst of all, in the middle of all of that, he ignores the enemy at the gate. I know that he ignores him because it wears the face of his son. But look at this description. It's hard for me to look at this because these things are being said about David. And it's hard to watch David let this happen. And it's hard because you can see it in so many times and so many places in the public arena and in the private arena. It says, Absalom used to rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. And when any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, from what city are you? And he would say, your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel. Then Absalom would say to him, see, your claims are good and right, but no man listens to you on the part of the king. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that one would appoint me judge in the land. Then every man who has any suit or cause would come to me, and I would give him justice. And when a man came near to prostrate himself before him, he would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And in this manner, Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. It's the kind of war that David doesn't know how to fight at this point. Give him a sword. give him an army to deal with. But the whispering campaign is about. And David, for a while, loses very badly to that. And I don't want to put all of that blame on David, to be sure. I don't know how aware he was of what was going on here. I do know that he has certainly played a part in creating this situation, if nothing else. But maybe at this point we turn for just a moment our attention to Absalom. Don't ever find yourself in the position of someone who stands at the gates and wins and politics the hearts to your side. It is, in biblical history, a very abominable place to find yourself. And when I say standing at the gates, just to be clear, I mean that gate and that gate and that gate and that gate. And if you're standing there saying, you're not going to get a fair hearing from these elders. And you may not be saying the part of, oh, if they would appoint me a judge, but if there are people here who think that, then go to the elders. And you say that to them. But don't work this scene behind the scenes. And let me say this about David. Particularly what is being said about David is not true. I mean, I can imagine no king in Israel, with the exception of perhaps Solomon, who I would more want to go to bring my case to than David. And so this is just a bald-faced lie, first of all. But here's how campaigning of this sort works, and I've seen it. I've seen it against good men, good gospel preachers. I've seen it against good politicians. Well, let me say this. Good men who tried to enter into politics, and they just don't stay there long. Because here's what happens. They get torn down. And what's so pitiful about this is they get torn down without ever having a trial. Without ever being able to give an answer, without ever being able to have both sides heard. Can you imagine having Absalom say these things right out in front of the people and listening to a legitimate response from David or anybody who would support David? Absalom couldn't last long, could he? So don't be an Absalom. What's more, what I wish would have been said here is that the people had looked at Absalom like he was crazy. I wish it would say that when they heard that, they thought, we know our king, and had marched right past him and gone and brought their suits to the king. But they believed him. And we have in our country developed this sense of it's the seriousness of the charge rather than the legitimacy of the evidence. And that's what happened here. It was the seriousness of the charge. It was not, there was no need to prove the case. There was only the need to sort of win people over to your side. Well, in this one point, I'll sort of say, I'm glad David is not a good politician. It just doesn't work in that world. And so to some degree, there will always be some loss to that. Don't be a part of that loss on either end. In all of this, I'll tell you what I see. I see David walking a fine line. Can you imagine all through this? When he's doing things right, we see the failures, but notice in some places how little there is, how little room there is between the success and the failure. Between when to show the graciousness and when to bring down the justice. And David is constantly, when he is succeeding, walking that line. And it just doesn't seem to take much to tip over. That's a stressful place to be. And I'll just tell you from my observations, it is a line and it is a balance the elders here are constantly trying to strike. I know you can't be there, and I can't be there all the times when they're having conversations about what the next thing to do is. But if you could, you would see that. You would see that struggle where you don't want to yield to any extreme, and you don't want to yield to the Joab over here, and you don't want to yield to the Absalom over here, and they're both pulling. And so I would say, let us not be either one of those characters, but let us be the one who stands behind David when he is doing right, who stands behind our elders when they are doing right. Let us be patient with and supportive of this congregation and of these elders as we navigate turbulent waters. And let us recognize that what we have in place, what we have as elders, are leaders qualified by the standards that God has laid out. And therefore, while there is distinction, to be sure, we have some similarities here between what the people had with David. God called David to be king. In a very real sense, God has called these men to lead. And so they must. And so we must help them in every way that we can in that effort. Well, maybe you're here this evening and you are not a Christian. And one of the things I would say to you is that in David's rising and falling, the thing that gives me the most comfort in all of that, as far as your considerations, are that David never stopped coming back to God. And so maybe you feel that you are in too big of a pit. You look at David's pit, and he crawled out of every single one of those and made himself a man after God's own heart. You could be that this very evening, and we could help you if you would let us know in any way while we stand and while we sing.